The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, Manindraji, early teacher, I think maybe Joseph's first teacher, said something that's been repeated often. If it's not simple, it's not vipassana. You know, if it's not simple, not vipassana. That strikes me as right. In the moments of insight or love or silence, the path feels incredibly simple, like we've just been released from the thicket of the mind and views and opinions, and it's a kind of perceptual shift that is self-evidencing. You know, it's like, in a sense, like freedom, small tastes or big gulps is its own evidence, you know. And but and maybe it's not good to pivot away from that, but the path of simplicity takes us through some very knotty terrain, and I'm trying my best to kind of understand the path, understand what we do, understand what's done to us, understand what, for me, what's been done to me by the path, and to make sense of it in a way that's hopefully useful, and understand the kind of mechanisms of change, how the Dharma gets under our skin and works itself. Because when we understand the mechanisms, it illuminates how to practice. And so the path is, you know, and I don't know how to teach, like, and I don't say that like to sound humble. I don't know how to teach. There are a lot of pedagogical choices you have to make, and you don't know if you're making the right one. You know, you don't know. And you just gotta kind of learn, you know, same way in the path. We just have to learn, you know, and do our best. But for me, in a way, even though the arising of the path and clarity, insight feels very simple, it's helpful to really understand some of the complexity of our practice. And that complexity often arises, it's not so hard to understand, it's just that the Dharma is often in dynamic tension. It's two rather than one. And yeah, it's hard for us. We want one teaching. We want to be told just to let go, or just to love, or just abide in emptiness or something. We want self-love, or we want no, not self. And many of the Dharma questions that arise are us leaning, just wanting one, but there's like, it operates as a dialectic. And Dharma traditions in a way have aided and abetted that habit of mind by, you know, like, putting one teaching on a pedestal. And in a sense, like Dharma teachers, we're sort of in the sales business, you know, and like the persuasion business, and but not for your money, but for your happiness, right? In sales, there's much more rhetorical force in one rather than two. Like, nuances don't get us hot and bothered, you know? It's like one, right? And and that has rhetorical force, you know? And so I remember one teacher said something like, in every moment, it's either success or failure. You either wake up or you don't. Lily just groaned in the front there. Or no, it wasn't you? No, it was Anna. It was Anna. Okay. But like, oh my God, that's a line. You know, that is a line. Every moment is a success or a failure. You either wake up or you don't. It's that dichotomous. You know, it's like, now if you hear that stuff, like, and it's just that line at light and the lines like that and lines like that, like, okay, that there's real potency in that, you know, but it winds up, I feel like, elevating one teaching above all the others. And a lot of the Dharma is found in these dynamic tensions. The simplicity, you know, appeals to the mind that is desperate to reduce causality. We're desperate for like monocausal models, single cause. We want that one thing. And the mind gets into these modes of if only. And we do that with spiritual teachings too. If only. But, monocausal models, just this thing, if only I, whatever, fill in the blank, let go or love or whatever. Monocausal models are usually the product of craving. And we crave that one thing resolves everything. And there's often some desperation in that. And the desperate mind never gets what it wants. So our path is often found as a kind of dialectic of acceptance and change, of tranquility and soothing, and then letting the enormity of dukkha rush into one's heart. It's about security, safety on the one hand, and then the kind of exposing the heart to what's undigested and equanimizing unpleasantness, meeting fear. It's about familiarity and not knowing, and today about stability and adaptability. It's balance of stability and then learning, novelty, new, being disoriented. And it strikes me that that distinction, stability and adaptability or new learning, is quite central in these teachings on self and selflessness. So in a way, you could say the self represents our stability, And from that stability, we open to the disorientation of the teachings on not self. So, you know, self is the familiarity of the known, and it functions as our ground and home base. And, you know, there's maybe ways in which in the morning, what I was saying could be heard as kind of like demonizing the self or something like that. It's not what's meant. It's the self. The self is not not an enemy. The self is not a thing. The self is an experience of identification. Self is an experience of identification. The sense of self is the temporary identification with a particular model of me, my place in the world. And the not in not self doesn't mean we dispute the content of that representation, me representing myself as a human or something, not disputing the content, I'm disidentifying with that process of that is me. So we represent ourself in represent ourself in consciousness, but we don't know it as a representation. And so the representation, using philosophical language, is transparent. And transparent means that perceptual objects or sense of self is experienced as thing-like, as mind-independent, as ultimately real, immediately given. And we don't see that it's a process of identification that creates the sense of thingness. And so we, from this vantage point, we think we're looking at the world, but we're looking at our mind in a sense. We're looking through self, you know. But this is okay. At least most of the time, this is okay. As we heal and as we wake up, we're still identified in many moments. But I would say that identification becomes more and more wholesome. That identification becomes more and more wholesome. It feels more and more comfortable, even if it never feels exactly like home. Even if the anatta is teachings on not self is a kind of homesickness. Like, I want a place to rest that actually feels secure. And self is never quite like that, but it feels more and more comfortable. The identification, there's less energy bound up in it. And so people, you know, hear these teachings on self and not self and want to jump in. They're kind of longing for like a final escape from identification. But we actually have to create the conditions both to understand the insight of not self and also to integrate it and square it with our identification. For it to be, for in a sense, you could say self and not self to be integrated. And so we create conditions. And in education research, there's something, you know, like learning readiness, right? With the ability to acquire understanding and initiate behaviors that lead to learning, successful learning. And the Dharma is about learning and learning readiness. Learning readiness. We actually have to make our mind, heart ready to learn. We cannot just sit down and say, I want to know, I want to learn. There's a lot that has to happen to become learning ready. And a lot of what we actually do is nurture stability. So, yeah, a retreat that I did some years ago with Gil, he does it fairly regularly. The theme was the three characteristics, dukkha, anicca, anatta, but paired with each of those is the apparent opposite. So with dukkha, suffering, well-being. So it's a talk on well-being, talk on dukkha, talk on stability, a talk on change, anicca, talk on self-confidence, a talk on anatta, not self. And stability allows us to deeply change and to not suffer from the disorientation where our ordinary moorings are uprooted. No. So chaos, in other words, cannot be digested by chaos, only by stability. And, you know, we talk on and on about anicca and uncertainty and impermanence and, you know, the changingness at the heart of all things. But I, every time I teach, I wear the same dumb clothes, you know. And when we go to retreat, we follow the same schedule, you know. We are counseled to sit at the same time. We repeat the same vows again and again, right? We read Mary Oliver's Wild Geese weekly basis, minimum. I saw a bumper sticker a few blocks from here that honk, it's only in Berkeley, honk if you're letting the soft animal of your body love what it loves. We go to secluded retreat centers, you know, often amidst nature, and we have like a highly routinized schedule. It's all made to be extremely predictable, you know. Okay, at IRC, right, it's like 5:30 wake up, 6 o'clock sit, 6:40 Sangha service, 7 o'clock, you know, all, it's like day after day, right? And when we change on the last full day, when the second evening sitting changes from 7:45 to 7:30, we basically give the yogis like a trigger warning, you know, like, just be ready. We're going to move the 7:45 sit to 7:30. You know, and I feel it too. I'm like, oh, okay, you know, change is coming, you know. Like, we establish incredible amount of predictability in how, in like the capacity to relax into a sense of stability by taking the precepts. You know, we take the precepts like, okay, actually, I'm not going to be startled by the behavior of others. We all vow not to harm each other, to be deeply respectful of each other, to be very careful about our impact on one another. And we establish tranquility, a huge part of the path. Maybe we say half the path is this kind of tranquilizing, soothing, this engendering a sense of stability. And samsara is sometimes likened to a flood, you know, and a flood of sense data. And you know, it's like our brain gates much of that. Like, imposes a lot of order on the blooming, buzzing, you know, cacophony of sensory experience, integrates a lot. And a lot of our energy, brain energy, goes into that. But in a way, the gates that our brain constructs are still inadequate. Too much still gets through. Life still feels a little overwhelming, even when things are okay. And so we cultivate this tranquility and this stillness, samadhi, you know, and this has the merciful effect of like slowing time down, slowing time down. And all of this stabilizes us. It stabilizes us, and we need it. We need it. And it is that experience of stability, you know, of trust, of regularity, kind of routines of the heart, you know, that actually allows us to adapt and grow and change and learn. This is Robin Carhart Harris and colleagues, and just published a couple of weeks ago in Nature Medicine. Human brain maintains a delicate balance between stability and adaptability. Stability supports the construction of a predictive model of reality, allowing us to navigate the present and anticipate the future. Adaptability enables the incorporation of new information. During normal waking consciousness, ensembles of interconnected neurons fire in synchronized and organized rhythms. The synchronized activity nested within large networks forms a stable scaffolding for brain activity. It's thought to encode a predictive model of the world that constructs, quote, reality from the inside out, supporting physiological and behavioral habits that are crucial to survival. These synchronized and predictable rhythms that help the brain to distill the torrent of incoming information into a workable picture of reality let us predict what will happen next. But when those patterns become rigid, the mind can get stuck in harmful cycles of thought that impact emotion and behavior, resulting in conditions like depression or anxiety, addiction. And psychedelic drugs, and this is what this review is about, psychedelic drugs appear to give a brief shake-up to entrenched patterns of brain activity. They disrupt established rhythms, which may open a window of time during which the brain becomes more flexible and able to lay down healthier patterns. So I'm not taking a position or trying to start a kind of exploration of psychedelic drugs, but to note that when I read that, like, oh, something very similar happens in Dharma practice. Especially intensive retreat, where we make everything incredibly predictable, stable. The soothing quality of repetition for our nervous system, so that we can then tolerate the disruptiveness of insight, the disruptiveness of renunciation. And it's the stability of self that permits insight into not self. In order to arrive at what you're not, you must go through the way which you are not. And what you do not know is the only thing you know. It's T.S. Eliot. And so retreat and Dharma practice generally is highly predictable and meant to induce some measure of internal chaos. Yeah? Did you hear that? You know? Some measure of chaos belongs. You know, like, but I like order, you know? Some measure of chaos belongs. And practice is not holding to order, but being reordered as we emerge out of chaotic states where all the kind of familiar reference points are not functioning in the same way. So the self is a kind of model and represents stability. You know, it's like only a concept doesn't change. You know, somebody teaches that. And the experience of self is a kind of experience of identification. And the identification increasingly feels okay. It's okay. It's relaxed. Yeah, I can be this. This identification is not, I don't flail in being identified in that way. And Jack Engler, you know, Buddhist psychologist, famously got this question about somebody with psychosis, who very highly diffuse, unstable sense of self, and asked, like, the person asked, like, are they close to understanding not self, you know? And he famously replied, you have to be somebody before you can be nobody. And the implication is that you have to have a kind of solid sense of self before you can shed that self. And many years later, he was asked to, you know, after that became a kind of mantra, you know, often repeated line, was asked to weigh in on that, maybe decades later. And he was at, you know, he says, yeah, well, I don't see it as quite that linear or exclusive anymore. In a general way, though, I would stand by it, that you have to be somebody before you can be nobody, although that's a provocative way of putting it. What I had in mind was that making that statement was that if you're going to go to the depths of Buddhist practice, which I was talking about, requires certain psychological capacities, which in the psychoanalytic tradition would be called certain basic ego strains. And those ego strains form around some stable sense of who you are, some stable sense of identity. And I still believe that's true. I might say that that the depths of Dharma practice actually don't require psychological health, but lacking psychological health, lacking a kind of stable, comfortable identification point, the depth of those experiences don't get integrated. You know, sometimes like, even the experiences of the depth of practice, they get kind of refracted through our psychological unfinished business or pain. And I have Dharma friends, you know, really, like, who have a lot of facility, you know. They're kind of like almost acrobatic with their mind, you know, and just very easy access to, you know, samadhi and jhana and the progress of insight and stages of insight, and just very, very easy access. And yet my experience is that, like, yeah, it's kind of like, it's like those experiences, you know, those insights, the fruit of practice did not get integrated and did not lead to, like, durable behavioral change and well-being, because it was almost like entropy meeting entropy, you know? There's the lack of stability in their kind of ordinary rhythms, and the lack of stability in the sense of self was kind of like that the chaos of that was met with more chaos and disruptiveness of those unusual perceptions of samadhi, of insight. And and so those experiences didn't kind of do for their life what one hopes they do. And so we develop this kind of like, kind of an ease with identification, that it's okay enough to be this self. And the self that is loved is much easier to release than the self that is hated. You know, much easier. The philosopher Wittgenstein said, philosophy is a battle against the bewitchment of our intelligence by means of language. The word self in the phrase self-love is not the same as the word self in the phrase not self. And, you know, self-love is not a kind of celebration of some permanent self-existing entity that is me. Self-love is not a kind of emotionally charged story about the essence of our being. That engenders fragility. Self-love is a kind of forgiveness. And it is understanding and honoring the totality of conditions that bring me into this form. In other words, self-love is a kind of perception of innocence. And so to love oneself is not to cherish or elevate the self. You know, it is, okay, I can be that. It's okay, good enough. And we don't flail when we're identified with that. And so in a way, self-love is a kind of a comfortable, cozy enough identification. Ajahn Sajito at a retreat at IRC says, first level of liberation is to have a good self. May sound strange because we talk about anatta, not self, but what it really means is that the landscape that your chitta, heart mind, is sitting on is pretty comfortable. It's fertile. It's green. You can move across it without getting blown up by something. No monsters lurking around, jumping on you. This itself is a profound benefit. And for those who go further, begin to dismantle the territory altogether. This is called the complete liberation. Chitta doesn't have territory, but that's another step. And then he laughed. Okay, Ajahn. That's funny. Self-love is, in other words, it's an expression of non-clinging. Of non-clinging. And maybe we even say self-love, like this deep self-acceptance, is like the first mini taste of the emptiness of self. Because self-hatred, arrogance, self-aggrandizement, all of that, a very ferocious identification. And self-love is this gentler identification, less volatile, more stable. So there are roughly two forms of self-clinging, often characterized this way. Something like ownership and identification. And this is mine, I am that. This is mine, I am that. We begin, you know, to to give up territory, our body, our mind, our life. It's like not exactly mine. And the famous sutta, let go of all that is not yours and what is not yours. The answer is, the Buddha responds, basically everything, the aggregates. Give up what is not yours. And we see when we claim territory, we become territorial, defensive. And very radical, but Andy Olensky, the very sense of ownership is directly responsible for both individual and collective suffering. Ownership is a node around which greed and hatred coagulate and is itself a profound delusion which gives rise to all sorts of strife. As the matter is succinctly put in the Dhammapada, quote, these children are mine, this wealth is mine, so are the misinformed, incensed. But even their selves aren't their own, let alone their children, let alone wealth. That is radical, And of course, in the ordinary sense, it's like, wear your shoes home, not mine, kind of, like, But we want to look what ownership does to the mind, the ways it is, as Olensky says, a node around which greed and hatred coagulate. And so, territoriality, identification. I said the self is represented in consciousness, but that representation is not evident. It's like it's transparent. It's immediately given. We do not know it as a phenomena that arises and passes. Is Chris Letheby, in ordinary waking consciousness, representations that are bound to the self model, including deeply held, often unconscious beliefs about ourselves and our lives, don't attract explicit attention or reflection. They are experienced as reality itself, or as that with which we see the world, rather than part of the world that we see. When this binding of these stimuli into the self model is disrupted, we disidentify with them in a very straightforward way, rendering them opaque. They're no longer experienced as part of me, but as something separate, an object or appearance in consciousness to which I can attend some sense of critical distance. The unbinding of mental contents from the self model, unbinding a lot of what we take ourself to be is unnoticed. And the thoughts and assumptions and the values that animate the moment are actually become known as objects in attention. We're kind of like turning the mirror back on the mind. And some of this unbinding is with the narrative self, like the stories we tell about who we are, what we want, and that becomes known. But some is more subtle. It's like the self is almost like muscle memory, like knowing where ASDF is on the keyboard or something. self is kind of like that. And we almost have to sense that body memory making that an object of consciousness. And we decenter, like what we, this model of self, we know that as just models, as models, not a kind of immutable essence. And so the subject, ordinarily we feel like we're in this like unmediated relationship with reality. It's just like, that's the world. I'm just looking at the world. Right? But we're now actually noticing that it is mediated by mind. You know, we normally just have this sense of just like in philosophy it's called naive realism, like just what I perceive is what's here. We fail to appreciate that it's mediated by mind, by assumption and craving and, you know, a sense of self and identification. And so now we begin to recognize that. Yeah. And there's a kind of kaleidoscopic shift, you know, from kind of more dukkha to less, more confinement to more space. And in a sense, almost nothing's changed, but everything's changed. And, you know, that which felt like the kind of origin of our light becomes illuminated. You know, like I sometimes say, the kind of spotlight operator of attention becomes illuminated more and more. And we felt like, okay, I am the spotlight, and now the spotlight is awash in luminosity. And the sense of, it's like the awareness that has always kind of tasted, hard to speak about, but tasted like self, becomes less and less and less. Becomes tasteless. And and so increasingly what there's still something being modeled. There's still, you could say, maybe identification. But what's being modeled is just luminosity or unpartitioned epistemic space, you know, is the way Foster Metzinger put it. Unpartitioned epistemic, knowing, the capacity to know. It's why I think traditions talk about like cognizance, knowing is like the essence of mind or something like that. We don't talk so much like that in the insight tradition, but we can come to just pare down, release, relinquish, become disenchanted, let go of this and this and this and this model and that assumption and that perspective, that center of gravity. Letting go until it dissolves. There's less and less being known, but the knowing brighter and brighter, more and more free. And then the self rearises, but we know its innocence. We can be at ease in that identification, and then we surrender that ground to awareness again, and more pervaded by some space. Then we live our life this way. And I feel like over time, experience of not self makes the experience of self healthier, less final, less fragile, more actually comfortable. The stability of self is paired in this dialectic with the kind of radical new learning of letting go. Okay, let's just sit for a moment. The words settle.